This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Later this hour, we'll meet Dr. Bruce McFadden. He's the first director of the University of Florida's new Thompson Earth Systems Institute, which will work to educate people of all ages about Earth's natural systems and how they interconnect, as well as all of the varied research being done into such systems at the university. But first, last fall, when Florida voters approved a constitutional amendment to restore voting rights to possibly more than a million former felons, liberals and conservatives alike celebrated what was to be the largest expansion of voting eligibility in the country since the elimination of poll taxes and literacy tests in the 1960s. Constitutional Amendment 4 restores voting rights to ex-felons, otherwise known as returning citizens, who have completed all the terms of their sentence, with the exception of those convicted of murder or felony sex offenses. Those who penned the amendment language, which was approved by the Florida Supreme Court before being allowed on the ballot, say it was intended to be self-executing and was intended to get legislators out of the business of deciding who gets to vote and who doesn't. Governor Ron DeSantis hasn't had much to say about the issue recently, but he's counted among opponents of the amendment and has previously stated his view that the amendment is not self-executing. DeSantis is among Florida elected officials who think state lawmakers need to pass some sort of legislation to clarify exactly who is eligible to have their voting rights restored through Amendment 4. And bills intending to do just that are moving in the state legislature. On Monday, the Senate Criminal Justice Committee advanced a proposal on a party-line vote with Republicans in favor and Democrats against that would include the payment of all fines and fees as part of a former felon's restitution in order to have their voting rights restored. The Senate Criminal Justice Committee is the only one the bill was assigned to, so it's now up for debate and a final vote on the Senate floor. And that's sparking debate over whether the proposal undermines the intent of Florida voters when nearly 65% of them voted in favor of Amendment 4 last fall. Joining me now for a closer look is Neil Vols, who lives here in Fort Myers, and he's political director of the bipartisan Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, which worked tirelessly to get the amendment on the ballot. Neil, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Great to speak with you again.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me. It's always fun to be on the show.
And we're also speaking with Kirk Bailey. He's political director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida. Thanks for taking the time to be with us as well.
Thanks, John. Pleasure to be here.
And as always, we invite listeners to join the conversation. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. And Kirk, before we delve into the intent of Amendment 4 in the details of, you know, these legislative proposals related to it that are currently under consideration, let's get some historical background on the broader issue itself. Could you give us some insight into how Florida came to have such restrictive policies when it comes to the restoration of voting rights in the first place?
Thank you, John. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the history of this particular lifetime disenfranchisement for felons stretches all the way back to 1868 when it was added to Florida's constitution and then sort of reaffirmed when the state reconsidered its constitution in the 1960s. The basic prohibition was that those with felony convictions could not get their voting rights restored unless they went before the clemency board of the state of Florida. And that was a very cumbersome process that left many individuals disenfranchised for their entire life. We were talking about 1.4 million individuals who were impacted by Amendment 4. Many of those folks were going through the clemency process. There were thousands of applications. There was a greater than seven-year backlog, I think more than 10,000 applications per year. And there was simply not an opportunity for all those individuals to have their voting rights and civil rights restored. And, of course, differing administrations would administer that process in different ways, making it harder or easier for individuals to get through it. But the fact of the matter was it wasn't addressing, you know, the more than a million people who were who had their voting rights disenfranchised. And so that's what led to the amendment that was successfully placed on the ballot by FRRC and its many partners, and what led to where we are today.
Yeah. Even more recent history, as I understand it, your organization, the ACLU of Florida's work, really kind of began on this after the 2000 election and that flawed felon purge list that then Governor Jeb Bush and then Secretary of State Catherine Harris had used, even after being warned not to, to remove thousands of people from the voter rolls. And, you know, then we see Governor Crist's administration expanding rules of executive clemency. That led to the restoration of voting rights to 155,000 people in just his single term in office. Then came former Governor Rick Scott, who instituted some executive clemency rules that drastically tightened the process of voting rights restoration. And, Neil, I'm wondering if those, you know, restrictive policies we saw under the Scott administration was kind of like the catalyst for your organization's push to get Amendment 4 going into high gear.
Yeah, in part that was definitely a catalyst. I think what we saw was decades of conversations from people in elected office saying that the system was broken and it needed to be fixed, but not really taking any action in that direction. And what you saw was the people and the families who were directly impacted by these policies, the folks dealing with the pain themselves, ultimately decided to take matters into their own hands, into our own hands. And you saw an amazing network of returning citizens and families and people and organizations who really care about these issues just begin a long, almost decade-long march to get Amendment 4 on the ballot. And it really was a testament of people taking this into their own hands. And so when we look at what's going on right now and we see partisan politics injecting itself into a process that was really built around unity and love and togetherness.
And bipartisanship, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, so let's get into the nuts and bolts of what's actually in Senate Bill 7086 when it comes to the payment of fines and fees. Because I imagine a lot of folks out there listening are like me and, you know, not really making much of a distinction between the terms fines and fees and kind of using them interchangeably. Kirk, why would that be a mistake? What's the difference and why does it matter in this case?
Yeah, thanks, John. It's a great question. You know, I probably should note just for a moment that, you know, our view of it certainly is that the amendment was self-executing and not just that it went into effect on January 8th, but that means that, you know, the legislature doesn't need to take action because the terms are clear. They can do things to supplement or expand the rights, but they really can't do anything under constitutional standards to limit the rights that have been granted by the people. And I think what's happening here in the definitions, frankly, in both House and Senate bills that relate to monetary obligations are doing exactly that. They're restricting the eligibility of individuals to vote. It would be a mistake to think that all monetary obligations are the same, right? And so restitution is one that's often understood pretty clearly. You know, that's what you need to pay back for the damage that you did for whatever offense was that you were convicted of. In the case of fines, there are often statutory fines that are associated with different offenses, and the judge will pan down when the sentence is imposed. And the same is true for fees, which are, you know, sort of different sorts of costs that are associated with the prosecution or the offense that are assigned. In all of those cases, though, it's important to note that they are assigned by the judge. They're part of the sentencing document at the time of your sentencing. And it's those items that we think need to be addressed in terms of completion of sentence.
Okay. So that Neil, did you want to weigh in on that?
No, just that I appreciate where Kirk's coming from and the legal conversation. And I tend to come at it from just a little bit more of a practical perspective, I think, of that there is a standard in place that has been used for decades involving completion of standards, completion of sentence as it relates to somebody with a past felony conviction getting the ability to vote back. And so for us, it's like, why would we change that now? And if so, why would we change it to restrict people from voting? Mm. And so it becomes a very practical conversation for those of us who do have past felony convictions and our families and our friends who sit around the kitchen table and talk about how this impacts our real lives. The truth is there's a difference between a fine given by a judge and a fine given by a debt collector and a fine given by a government employee at the Department of Corrections. Those are fundamentally different things. And sometimes people want to assign a term to mean the same thing in all different cases. And right. We believe it's very practical to say this revolves around what the judge says.
Right. Okay. And that relates to something else I've been seeing surface in this debate relating to monetary requirements. And then sometimes those in felony cases being converted from criminal actions to civil actions by a judge. So, you know, in other words, a payment of restitution can be converted into a civil lien that somebody who, you know, can't afford to pay it all at once can then make monthly payments on. Can you explain that, Kirk, and how that practice comes into play in this debate? And is that something that happens often in felony cases?
Yeah, thanks, John. You described it exactly right. I mean, in many cases, restitution or other monetary obligations that are part of the terms of sentence, once an individual has completed their probation or parole or other terms of their sentence, we'll find their monetary obligations are converted into a civil lien. And I think it's really important for folks to know that that doesn't mean the individual is off the hook. They still have to pay that money. But in the eyes of the criminal justice system, it's not considered a part of their term of sentence anymore. It's a civil obligation. It has changed from what would be a criminal penalty to a civil obligation. And so in our view, that takes it out of what the constitutional amendment was referring to in terms of sentence.
Okay, so from your perspective, you know, somebody who's had that kind of restitution converted into a civil lien, like that shouldn't even really even be a factor. Like it shouldn't matter even whether or not they're dutifully making those payments as they're supposed to. It's separate.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay. I mean, they are dutifully making their payments and paying that part of it back. But in the eyes of the criminal justice system, they've completed their term of sentence. And on the plain text of the language, that means that their voting rights are restored.
And is that where we're getting these, you know, charges, I think perhaps most notably via Twitter from freshman Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez saying that this proposal amounts to a poll tax? Neil?
Yeah, I mean, this debate sure has taken a lot of different turns, and lots of different people have different perspectives. I know from the returning citizen community perspective that isn't the kind of language that we use. Mm-hmm. We are focused very squarely on the real lives of real people and how these policies would impact us. And so we're just kind of going straight at it and reminding people what the impact would have if you had a system in place in which somebody who doesn't have money would not be able to vote, and somebody who does would be able to vote. I think that is something that flies in the face of the morality and the morals of all people. And once we have a chance to have a real conversation about it, we hope and we believe that people will begin to see this through the lens of our common universal values, and we can begin to get back to the system that was set up in the first place, which we believe is the good place to start.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with American Civil Liberties Union of Florida Political Director Kirk Bailey and Florida Right to Restoration Coalition Political Director Neil Vols. We're discussing Amendment 4, which restores voting rights to most former felons here in Florida, and the debate over legislative efforts aimed at further interpreting the amendment. I invite listeners to connect with our guests. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. And I wanted to bring up, I know that in 1998, Florida voters approved a constitutional amendment requiring that the state's court system be entirely funded through fines and fees. And as I understand it, we're the only state in the country with that kind of a funding model for the court system. Is that part of the problem here? And by that, I mean simply how the Florida court system itself is funded?
Yeah, sure. Happy to try to address that question. You know, I think it is part of the dynamic in the background is certainly the funding for the court system. You know, I do think it's important to stress, however, that none of this conversation about the monetary obligations around Amendment 4 and its implementation is suggesting that these expenses not be paid. Like I mentioned before, even if it's turned into a civil lien, the individual still has to pay that money. And so ostensibly it's going into the court system in that manner. It's just not a part of their criminal penalty. So nobody's suggesting that folks don't have to pay. Only that these exorbitant fees and costs should not be part of their term of sentence and prohibit them from being able to register to vote.
Go ahead, Neil.
Well, and even to add to some of this conversation, once we really start to get into these specific instances, and we're seeing that a lot where people are talking about, well, what about in this case or what about in that case or what about in this case? And one of the challenges we face when we start going down that road is you start chasing a piece of paper that's 30, 40 years old. You're going to start creating new bureaucracies, spending millions of dollars. And people didn't vote for that when they voted for Amendment 4. There is already an existing process and standard in place that I think is a good benchmark, and we can get back to a place where we're focused on people's lives and allowing folks to get reintegrated into the community and creating safer family communities and stronger families and all those things that I think were so aspirational and unified us as we moved this together, and we're just hoping to take a step back in that direction.
Yeah. Kirk, if the bill is passed by the legislature, the Senate version as it stands now, do you think that it would – I mean, obviously you would argue that that violates the intent of Amendment 4, but do you think it could also violate that amendment passed back in 1998 pertaining to funding of the court system simply because that really didn't have anything to do as far as the voter language with the restoration of voting rights at all? It was just a funding matter.
Yeah, John, maybe I need to ask clarify the question. Are you asking whether or not the revisions in the Senate bill would violate the funding requirements of the 98 Amendment?
Yeah, if that's something, an argument that you might use if it comes to that.
You know, to be brutally honest about it, I don't think we've briefed that issue deeply enough for me to speculate on it right now. Like
sure.
I said before, I don't think that the provisions of Amendment 4 interfere with the basic funding structure that's in place, and so I wouldn't see it as undercutting how the clerks in the criminal justice system are funded, but certainly there might be some constitutional dynamics there that we haven't briefed yet. So I appreciate you raising it.
Okay, and Neil, I'm just wondering if you find it a bit frustrating to watch this debate taking place at all, and by that I mean, it seems like a lot of what we're seeing in Tallahassee now is speculation over the intent of the language in Amendment 4, as though we have to guess when lawmakers could, we could go to the people who wrote the ballot language and ask them directly what they meant. One of them is, Howard Simon, former executive director of the ACLU.
Yeah, I mean, on a personal level, that can be frustrating. But I also know that we're talking about people's lives, and we're focused on real impact on communities, and so that's important for us to engage in these conversations. And the way that I view it is that, yes, there's a conversation going on about the, for instance, the definition of completion of sentence. But at its heart is really a debate about whether it's the people making decisions or the elected officials and the politicians. And we think the people spoke very clearly. The language had been approved by the Senate, and the legislation is not necessary. So we understand the give and take of public debate. And frankly, as somebody who just through the vote of the people was able to get my ability to have my voice heard back and have a voting card now, it's great to be a part of that process, and I want to continue to see that as what it is, as self-government, as work, and that's what we're doing. But yeah, to your point, this is something that the people spoke very clearly about. The language was very clear, and so it can get frustrating when all of a sudden other agendas, partisan agendas, personal agendas, short-term agendas suddenly get in, and you start to feel things become more divisive when it was really a unifying moment on election night when 65% of the voters supported Amendment 4.
Right. And I don't want to necessarily go back and, parse out the 13-year-old details of your long story involved in all this. We've done that in previous conversations, and if listeners want to point to that, we can do that. But can you take us back to that day in early January when you went to the Lee County Supervisor of Elections office to register to vote? I mean, what did that feel like? What did that mean to you?
I got to tell you, that day was overwhelming. Like that, what felt like what it is going on all across the state is the biggest expansion of democracy in 50 years. And,
yeah.
And it's happening in our state, and we got to do it with family, friends, other folks who had the ability to vote restored through Amendment 4. We all had breakfast. We went down. Tommy Doyle, our supervisor of elections, was there. They rolled out the red carpet for us. The flags were waving. Lots of tears, lots of crying, and lots of hugging. And it was a real special kind of patriotic moment full of gratitude for where we were. And so I know that that was going on all across the state. And I know that deep, deep down, that is the heartbeat of this entire movement and what's going on. And we understand that there's going to be, you know, some conversations and people trying to take moves and do things for a variety of different reasons. But we know that deep down, the people of the state of Florida believe that when a debt's paid, it's paid, and that they believe in second chances for people, and know that when we embrace second chances, we can create safer communities and better families and lives for people right here in Southwest Florida.
Yeah. And Neil, can you speak to the restoration of voting rights as sort of a tool towards, I guess, reintegration and reducing recidivism?
Yeah, you know what? All the studies show, the data that we've collected from universities, from people on the right, people on the left, even from the Florida government, all show that when people are able to reintegrate into their communities and have a voice, for instance, having the ability to vote restored, we've seen studies that show that people are three times less likely to reoffend. So if you start doing the math on that and thinking about how many people, a million plus people are impacted in the state of Florida, every community impacted, you start talking about seeing real tangible impact in your community on things like less crime, the ability to have a better job base because of less crime. There really are a lot of tangible impacts that people who aren't even impacted by the criminal justice system will see in their real lives in terms of better communities and stronger families.
Right. And Kirk, you know, the Senate bill is getting all the attention this week because, you know, that's the one that's cleared the committee process. But there's also proposals in the State House related to Amendment 4 as well. I imagine you're following those. Can you maybe speak to those, particularly regarding the idea of trying to define what constitutes a sex-related felony under the amendment?
Yeah, thank you, John. There are bills on both sides, the Senate and the House, as you correctly point out. The House bill is much more expansive than the Senate bill in all of its terms, whether it's trying to define felony sexual offenses or the monetary obligations that are owed. In the case of the felony sexual offenses, it clearly goes beyond what the plain text of the language is. I mean, the amendment itself and the now constitutional provision talks about felony sexual offenses. And that was, you know, to your earlier point about what the sponsors intended, it was intended to be rape, crimes that are in the sexual battery statute, and those for which an individual would need to register as a sex offender. However, the House bill goes much further than that, including some offenses that, while terrible, are not felony sexual offenses. There's one about video voyeurism, and there's one about placing a sex shop close to a school, and there's one related to, you know, what's commonly referred to as sexting between teenagers. All those, we can talk all day long about how bad they are and how we need to address them in the criminal justice system, but the truth of the matter is they're not included in the statutory references to felony sexual offenses. And so it's much too broad, and we've obviously been encouraging the House and Senate to withdraw those from their legislation.
Is that, you know, reference in the amendment language itself something you might consider a weakness, simply because it's kind of a broad sort of undefined term? And I understand you saying that this was intended to apply to, you know, a crime that would require someone to be on the state sex offender registry. But the amendment doesn't actually spell that out.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But I wouldn't agree with the notion that it's unclear. I mean, it's important to note that the Supreme Court considered this language and in their opinion noted that the language was specific and unambiguous. And it's also worth noting that the language uses sort of legal terms of art in its terms itself. So murder is a commonly understood term both in public parlance, if you will. We've all seen enough Law and Order episodes to know what murder means, but it's also specifically defined in Florida statute. And the same is true for felony sexual offenses. And the court is deemed to have known that when they authorized the language and made their comment about it being, you know, specific and unambiguous. And so the legislature really should take notice of that as well. And the trouble is that they're including things that are not within those definitions, not within those provisions of Florida law that already speak to these issues. So even though on its face it might look like the phrase felony sexual offense is a little bit broad, as I said before, it's a term of art that refers to a very specific definition that's already in Florida statute.
Right. Neil, does it seem odd to you that this debate at all has taken on such a partisan tenor? And by that I mean, do you think that there's maybe this false conception about returning citizens sort of being lumped together in the minds of perhaps some GOP lawmakers as this homogenous voting bloc that wouldn't support candidates of their party?
Yeah, I would definitely say that it has been disheartening to kind of watch partisan politics inject itself into this conversation, because when I think about the returning citizen community, you know, I think about the pastor in Fort Myers. I think about the small business owner in Cape Coral or the single mom down in Bonita Springs. You know, these are real people who have lived real lives. And the beauty of Amendment 4 was that when people went into the voting booth in November, they weren't voting for a partisan agenda. They were voting for their friend or their neighbor or family member. Member, somebody who was impacted by policies that by any standard just were broken and not working. And so, when we think about Amendment 4, we think about a spirit of inclusiveness and unity and love and believe that those are the things that can help us as we move forward too. And so it was fun this week. We had vans full of returning citizens in the Capitol who got to share their stories and talk. And I believe that they're helping to bridge that gap between people who have a real world understanding of the criminal justice system and those who might not. Sometimes it's just much better to bridge that gap and have real conversations, which is why I'm always grateful for a show like this where you get a chance to really dig into issues, because we can start to see that we have more in common with each other than we have differences.
Right, right. And Kirk, given the razor thin margins of victory we saw in several statewide races last fall, and also in previous elections here in Florida, I guess, can you speak to the potential impact of Amendment 4 when it comes to shaping the outcome of elections? Again, reiterating, you know, being a returning citizen doesn't necessarily inform what party you're going to register with. But adding potentially 1.4 million new voters to the rolls, that could be a game changer in future elections.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I wouldn't speculate as to how folks are going to register or how they might vote. And in fact, I don't think there's been any good information out there about how that's going to play itself out. But one thing I do want to emphasize is that it's clear that more folks will be registering and therefore participating in our democracy. Just in the first month of registration, after Amendment 4 went into effect, we saw a 36% increase in registrations this last January over a year ago January. And so what is really exciting for us is that just more people are engaged in their democracy and participating in their communities in exactly the way that Neil just mentioned. You know, I think what's exciting is that they're going to turn out for local elections where they're voting on, funding for local community centers or for transportation projects in their communities. And I think that's where we're going to see the real impact here, is individuals who are participating in the system and nudging our leaders towards taking care of their communities, having, solid infrastructure, transportation, community services programs. I think all of that's going to be a sea change in how policy goes forward in Florida, regardless of how it impacts, partisan political debates.
So ideally, Kirk, what do you see as what would the ACLU like to see happen with the implementation of Amendment 4? Because, we know the Department of State has the ultimate authority on elections here in Florida. Should they basically just be, looking at new voter registrations or any voter registrations and just making sure the person hasn't been convicted of a felony murder or is on the state sex offender registry? And, those systems already exist. So it doesn't seem like what you're seeking in terms of implementing this amendment wouldn't really take much extra action beyond what election officials are already doing.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And we've made clear in letters to the Secretary of State and to the legislature itself that we think that the executive agencies can take action to refine their processes to be able to, confirm the questions that need to be confirmed about any particular individual's eligibility to register to vote. They have authority to do that under existing statute, and they should be allowed to proceed. And I think if they run into trouble along the way, the legislature has an understandable oversight function. The agency agencies can say, you know, we've run into this particular problem down the road and ask for clarifying legislation that might be helpful. I think it's not necessary to do it from an implementation standpoint, but right now. But there is a conversation that happens around how state programs are administered that I think down the road we're anticipating will need to be dealt with. I do think there's one thing that the legislature could do right now, however, which is pass, appropriate funding for the state agencies involved to make sure that they have the capacity to be able to register these individuals and improve their databases and their systems. And that ought to be the conversation that we're having, really, is how are we funding these agencies to do the job that the legislature of the people has really asked them to do.
Yeah. Kirk, would it be fair to say that, you know, if the Senate bill, as it appears now, passes the legislative process, there'll be a pending legal challenge from your organization or from the from your coalition, Neil?
Lyle, happy to answer that. I mean,
yes.
We don't comment on specific litigation upcoming. Certainly, we're monitoring it. And I think depending on what the final package looks like, it may present constitutional challenges. And of course, we would evaluate those at that time. But it's a little early to speculate on what those might look like right now.
All right. Neil, and I'll ask you to respond to that same question as a representative of the coalition. And I'll give you the final word today.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to continue to just kind of monitor this and focus on the entire process through the lens of less of a political science or legal, debate, and just really focus it on the people. We're talking about millions of lives, and that's the heartbeat of this movement. And it isn't just about one session of the legislature. This is about a long, long continuing movement that will allow people to reintegrate into the communities, transform our communities in a positive way. And I'm just really excited about the transformation that began with Amendment 4. It took us 10 years to get here, and we know that we're going to continue to develop this constituency and integrate into the communities. Our next steps will include things like voter registration and voter education and getting people civically engaged and just keep moving forward in a positive way, because at the end of the day, this is about people and families and dealing with politics and partisanship, but not being driven by that.
Gotcha. Well, that is all the time we have for this part of the show, but I want to thank my guests. We've been speaking with Neil Vohls, political director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Neil, thanks as always for your time.
Hey, thanks so much.
And Kirk Bailey is the current political director for the ACLU of Florida. Kirk, great to connect with you as well.
Thank you for your time, John.
When we return, we're going to learn about a new institute at the University of Florida that's focusing on Earth's natural systems, like air, water, land, and life, how they interconnect, and what current research is teaching us about them. I'm John Davis, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.